11. I don't know if Terry was happier to see me, or if I was happier to see her. I'd never believed the adage that absence makes the heart grow fonder, but in this case, it had. She was waiting for me when I arrived back in Orange, and before I'd even gotten out of the car in front of her apartment building, she was running toward me, arms outstretched. She ran into me so hard that I would have been knocked down had she not immediately hugged me so tightly. I felt kisses on my cheeks and forehead, and then on my lips, and I kissed her back gratefully, happily, passionately. I'd called Terry immediately after discovering how long I'd been in Frank's house, and found that she was panicked, having left over 30 messages on my phone. She hadn't heard from me, hadn't been able to get a hold of me, and every scenario that ran through her head was either a disaster or a tragedy. I'd fallen asleep while driving, crashed into a semi-truck, and had been burned so far beyond recognition that my body could not be identified. I had been forced off the road and over a cliff, where my car had exploded. I'd slipped on a wet sidewalk and hit my head, and suffered a brain aneurysm. I'd choked to death in my sleep in an unknown motel. She'd contacted the police to report my disappearance, but since she wasn't a relative, I was officially on leave from my job, and the only indication she had that I was missing was the fact that I wasn't answering my phone, the cops told her there was nothing they could do. She would need more proof of my disappearance in order for them to investigate. It had made her frantic, and she'd been calling and emailing every law enforcement and government agency she could think of. While it had been a nightmare for her, I was actually glad that she hadn't succeeded in convincing the police to undertake a big search. Now I wouldn't have to prove that I was really me. Not to mention accounting for my whereabouts every minute over the past week. I told her the truth about what had happened. There was no reason not to. And now, I wondered why I hadn't done so before. I left nothing out, and made no effort to sugarcoat any part of it. Either I would frighten her off, or she would understand and accept. But either way, everything would be out in the open and there would be no secrets. I was done with secrets. I was still baffled by what had happened during my 5 minutes, 6 days, in the house, and was tempted to disbelieve it myself, even though I knew it to be true. The loss of time frightened me more than anything else ever had, more than the trip back to Randall, more than the B&B ghost in Texas. Those, at least, were expected and relatable. This was something entirely different. A complete revocation of the laws of physics. Even as I described it all to Terry, I was aware of how absurd it sounded, and I would not have blamed her had she gotten mad at me for lying and spinning such an outrageous story, or if she'd run away, thinking me crazy. Thankfully, she didn't either. She absorbed what I said, and even if she didn't buy all of it, she apparently knew me well enough to understand that I thought it was true. And for now, that was good enough for her. Besides, she teased, I'll be able to watch part of this on Ghost Pursuers, won't I? I hugged her tightly, nearly overcome with emotion, not realizing until that moment how important it was to have someone by my side, someone who believed in me. We talked for hours, going over the details of everything that had happened, examining it all with the thoroughness of grad students analyzing a Faulkner novel. She had questions, of course, but I had questions too. Had he really dug up my mom's bones? That was the big one. That was the question that haunted me. And the only two options, as I saw it, were to believe that Frank had been lying in order to get my goat, or to have my mom's body exhumed to see if it was still there. The first was obviously preferable, but I wasn't sure I'd be able to live with the uncertainty. The thought of having her dug up after all this time, though, made me sick to my stomach. Terry put her hand on mine. This Frank's always been a liar, hasn't he? Let her rest. But he knew the cemetery. Let her rest. I nodded tiredly. It was good advice. I decided to take it. For now. Sandy Simmons had died in my absence. I learned what happened when I called to let her know that I had found Frank. I dialed her number, but the connection was automatically switched over to Brad's phone. And when I asked to speak to her, he told me the news. She'd never awakened from her coma, and the official cause of death was organ failure. But I knew the real reason. Frank. I expressed my condolences to Brad, but decided to leave it at that. I wasn't going to investigate further. I wasn't going to get involved. I was done with all that. It was time to move on. I'd alerted the authorities about Frank, and whatever happened next was up to them. I would testify in court if need be. I would share whatever information I had, but I was through with any sort of solo quest. I hoped Frank would go to jail, but if not, he could rot out there in his mausoleum in the desert. My part in this was over. It felt good to concede that. I was starting fresh, beginning anew. I'd dumped all my baggage, and one of my first decisions as a free man involved Terry. I was going to ask her to move in with me. I did so over dinner in a way that I'd seen in a movie. I made an extra key to my house, put it in a small box, and wrapped it up, giving it to her in a nice restaurant right before dessert. There was a slight moment of panic when I realized that she might think this was a proposal and that the box contained a ring, but the idea didn't appear to even cross her mind. She seemed genuinely in the dark about what the box might contain, and she was completely surprised when she saw the key, and I explained that I thought we should move in together. It took some convincing. She'd lived in her apartment for the past 10 years and was more than a little attached to it. The location was convenient for work, and she liked the neighborhood. Though she didn't say so, I'm sure she was also afraid that if things didn't work out between us and she gave up the apartment, she would not be able to find a place quite as nice. So we settled on a compromise. She would move in with me, but keep her apartment for a while, just in case. "You're not offended?" she asked. I laughed. "Not at all. In real estate, we advise people to do things like this all the time. Doubles up on our commissions." "But you're not selling me anything. Or renting me anything." "I know, but I understand. It's the unmarried cohabitant's version of a prenup." "It's smart." She kissed me. "I'm smart, and you're understanding. We make a good team." "I think we do," I said. My house was a 3-bedroom, 2-bath ranch style in a nice neighborhood on the border of Anaheim Hills. I'd been using one room just for storage, but I moved all my crap into the garage and let Terry have the room for whatever she wanted. Her furniture was nicer than mine, or at least displayed more style. So over the next weekend, using a rented U-Haul truck and the free labor of friends, we switched out my bed for hers, swapped dressers and couches, and the end result was that her now unused apartment looked more like my house, while my house, our house now, looked more like her apartment, which was probably for the best. You get a lot closer to people when you live with them, rather than just date. But if either of us were concerned about the implications of that, we needn't have been. Not only were we compatible as roommates, but our relationship was deepened by the increased exposure. We were who we thought we were. Only more so. I could imagine us married, in a way that I had not been able to before. I could see us spending the rest of our lives together. I had nightmares, apparently, but I didn't remember them, and only the fact that I awoke to Terry's soothing reassurances and her soft hands on my face clued me in that something was amiss. She told me, after the first time, that she'd been awakened by me thrashing around in the bed and crying out in my sleep, and though I didn't remember anything, I was grateful for her comforting presence. When it happened again, however, and again, I began to feel guilty. I shouldn't have been putting her through this. She didn't seem to mind, though. She was patient and understanding, and she was always there. We started carpooling to work. Her job required her to stay in her office all day, while mine often had me out showing houses, so it made sense that I was the one to drive. She could save on gas money and wear and tear on her car, not to mention the fact that we could enjoy each other's company as we commuted. The bank headquarters where she worked was a little out of my way, but not inconveniently so. And we developed a routine, leaving the house around 7, stopping at a Starbucks near Orange Mall for some coffee, driving past Disneyland, then sitting in the car in the parking lot of her office building, talking until it was time for her to go in. Life was good. And except for those nightmares that I didn't remember, I seemed to have put Frank and the past behind me. A month or so later, we went on a weekend trip to meet her family. I knew Terry had a sister, and I knew that both of her parents were still alive, but they'd never appeared to be close, and I was surprised when she suggested that we visit. Terry was from a small town in San Diego County called Ramona, a farming community in the mountain foothills some 20 miles past the San Diego Wild Animal Park. Her parents still lived in her childhood home, and both of her sister's families lived in nearby Escondido. They were all waiting for us when we arrived, the small driveway filled with 2 pickups and an SUV. I parked on the street, and by the time we got out of the car, we were engulfed in hugs and well wishes. Unbeknownst to me, Terry had sent them my picture from her phone, so I was at a disadvantage. I had never seen anyone before, and had to be introduced several times to the same people before I got their names straight. The house was a late 20th century tract home, built in a subdivision that appeared to be a buffer zone between the quaint downtown and the surrounding farms and chicken ranches. Inside, the fireplace mantel and tables were full of framed photos featuring Terry and her sisters, and I examined them closely. I'd never seen what she looked like as a child, and was not surprised to see that she'd been the cutest of the three. Both of her sisters were pretty, though, as was her mom, which boded well for Terry's future. Iced tea and water were distributed to those who wanted them, and then began the serious matter of the Inquisition. Julie was the sister with children, and her husband Ron took the kids outside to play, while the rest of us remained in the living room. Under the guise of a casual conversation, my romantic history, financial prospects, and intentions toward Terry were extracted. And while I definitely had more painful encounters in the past, meeting the family was never fun. I must have passed the test, though, because they eased off fairly quickly, and as the topic shifted from me to family gossip, I sensed no underlying hostility. Real estate had made me into a facile conversationalist, but there was no need to fall back on my professional skills. Her dad and I genuinely hit it off, and while the rest of the family talked about people I didn't know, and incidents I hadn't been a part of, we discussed Humphrey Bogart movies. Sometime in the middle of the conversation, I heard a baby crying in a back bedroom. Assuming it was one of her sisters, I waited for someone to get up and go to the infant, to comfort it or feed it or change its diaper or do whatever needed to be done. But either no one else heard the cries, or they were all ignoring it. So I finally asked, "Isn't someone going to check on the baby?" Julie frowned. "What baby?" Sure enough, the sound had stopped. I looked from face to face, confused. "I thought I heard a baby crying." "No," Terry's mom said. "Maybe it was next door or something," Julie suggested. "The window's open." "Probably," I said, nodding. Everyone went back to their conversations, and eventually we went out to a Mexican restaurant for lunch. Terry asked me about it that night.
"What was that?"
"What was what?"
"That whole thing with the baby."
"Nothing. I just thought I heard a baby crying."
"Don't give me that.
It wasn't nothing." I could feel her eyes on me.
"It really was,"
I told her. But I could tell from the expression on her face when I glanced over that she was suspicious. I couldn't blame her. She'd heard a lot of craziness from me lately, and either she'd bought into it all, or she loved me enough to pretend that she did. Whichever, she was obviously on the alert for any odd behavior that I might exhibit. "Seriously," I said.
"Okay,"
she declared after a moment, still not satisfied, but apparently willing to let it go. The rest of the short weekend was spent exploring Ramona and the nearby mountain town of Julian with her family. We had to endure numerous unsubtle hints from her mother about getting married, but though Terry found it annoying, and told her mom so, I thought it was kind of sweet. For the first time in my life,
I could actually see myself getting married. And I could tell that Terry, despite her objections, had thoughts along the same lines.
I have only the dark wife now.
One thing that spending time with her family made me realize was how much I missed my own family. I wish my parents could have lived to see how I turned out. Wish they were alive to meet Terry. And I wished Billy was here too.
The uptick in housing sales that had started at the end of summer continued into the beginning of fall. And what had begun as a bad year economically was turning out to be pretty good.
I sold 4 houses in a 6-week period, one of them a multi-million-dollar residence on Skyline Drive in Fullerton. And I listed 3 properties from past clients that were on very desirable streets in upscale neighborhoods and were bound to go quickly. One of the clients turned me on to some new music I'd never heard before, an ensemble called the Helix Collective, and I found myself downloading their album All In and listening to it incessantly, the soundtrack to my fall selling season. One busy Tuesday, after showing houses to a Korean family who wanted to move into the Sunny Hills High School District, I was washing my hands in the restroom at the office and preparing to eat a late lunch when, beneath the sound of the running water, I thought I heard the wail of a baby. The cry was faint, as though coming from very far away, and the second I turned off the faucet, it was gone. Had it been there at all? I wasn't sure, and just to check, I turned the water on again. There was indeed a high-pitched whine on the pipes. Could that have been it? I didn't think so, but it was possible. It was also the most logical explanation, although logical explanations had been in short supply lately. I checked with May and Mike, who were both at their desks, but neither of them had heard a thing. Just as with Terry's family, the baby's cries seemed to exist only for my benefit, and I spent the rest of the day in the office, catching up on paperwork, waiting to see if it would happen again. It did not, and when I went to the bathroom a few hours later, even the pipes were silent. We made love after dinner that night. Terry was on her hands and knees, and I was taking her from behind, when beneath her uninhibited screams of pleasure, I heard a baby cry. I stopped, pulling out, but the sound did not repeat.
What are you doing? She demanded breathlessly. Put it back in.
I did, but my concentration was shot, my erection fading, and I hardly finished her off without coming myself. Still breathing hard, she stood, a look of concern on her face.
What's wrong?
She asked, stepping over our pile of discarded clothes. Nothing, I told her.
But you didn't?
I thought I heard a baby crying. Silence greeted my admission. I know, I'm probably imagining it.
I don't think you're imagining it.
We looked at each other. It felt good to hear her say that. It felt terrible to hear her say that. She put her arms around me, pulled me close. We were both still naked, and the feel of her soft skin aroused me again. Smiling, she pulled me onto the floor and made me finish what we'd started. I heard the baby crying again in the middle of it, but this time I ignored the sound. And by the time we were finished, the noise had stopped. Was I being haunted? It almost seemed so, as though the ghost of a baby had attached itself to me instead of to the location where it had died. Had I picked up the ghost at the B&B in Biscuitville? Or at Frank's house outside Feldspar? Maybe it was the ghost of a baby that Terry had lost or aborted before she met me. I pushed that thought aside, knowing I was being an asshole for even thinking it. This whole thing had me rattled, and I had not been on sure footing since returning to Randall. The crying baby disappeared, at least for a while. But a week or two later, I inherited a listing from May for a house that was supposed to be haunted. That was not the sort of thing that we would ever acknowledge to the general public. But realtors talk among themselves, and if a residence ever had a cold spot or mysterious shadows or unexplained noises, we all know about it. I asked for the listing because I wanted to compare the vibe with what I'd felt at the various Frank houses,
to see if there was any difference between an ordinary haunting and whatever it was that Frank was involved with. My first impulse was to keep it a secret. I was not used to sharing, but I decided to tell Terry. And over dinner, I casually revealed my plan, making it seem like it was no big deal. It felt like an adventure to her, and she wanted to go with me. So the next day, a Saturday, I stopped by the office for the key to the lockbox before we proceeded to the house. Located in an older section of La Habra, it was a single-story Mediterranean-style home from the 1940s, unusually well-maintained for the surrounding neighborhood. Once inside, I felt nothing. Terry didn't either. We walked from room to room, listening in vain for odd noises, trying to pick up on any uncomfortable sensations, but we encountered nothing out of the ordinary. Disappointed, I turned to Terry. "You sure you don't feel anything?" She shook her head. "Me either," I sighed. "I guess we're not sensitive enough. Maybe you should bring a psychic here. Or at least a Ouija board." I wasn't sure I believed in psychics, but if there was one who was real, I wondered what he or she would make of a Frank house. I shook my head. Why was I even doing this? Why was I pursuing such a line of thought? I was supposed to be done with it all. I was supposed to have opted out. From somewhere in the garage, I heard the faint cry of a baby. The hair prickled on the back of my neck. That was why. I might want to be through with all of this paranormal activity, but it clearly wasn't through with me. The cry came again. Maybe I should contact the team from Ghost Pursuers. Yes. Why hadn't I thought of it before? I listened to the crying coming from the garage. "Do you hear that?" I asked Terry. She frowned. "No. What is it?" Understanding dawned in her face. "The baby?" She followed me back into the kitchen and through the side door that led into the garage. I reached for the light switch and flipped it on. The garage was empty, an open beamed room built on an oil-stained slab of concrete. I stood there for a moment, waiting for the baby to cry again, knowing it wouldn't. "Wah!" It was a single soft wail, coming from the center of the open space before me, and every hair on my body stood on end. I turned to Terry. "Did you hear?" She shook her head. Summoning every ounce of courage I possessed, I stepped into the center of the garage. I heard nothing, but there was a fleeting sensation of cold, as though I'd walked in front of an air conditioner that suddenly shut off. I looked around the garage, wondering where the baby had gone, wondering if it was a baby. "Anything?" Terry asked. I shook my head. "Let's go." As soon as we got home, I emailed the Ghost Pursuers team. I'd been given a generic email for the production company, but I addressed my message specifically to Scott Spencer, hoping that the producer would get back to me if he saw my name. I considered giving him a detailed account of my search for Frank, but figured I could go into all that later. Instead, I simply told him that I'd found another haunted house, one built and owned by the same man who'd built the two houses in Randall. I urged him to contact me ASAP. I still hadn't decided whether I would accompany the team to Nevada. I was supposed to be out of it, wasn't I? But I desperately wanted Spencer and his crew to investigate that mirror-windowed home out in the middle of nowhere. The police certainly hadn't come through for me. I wasn't even sure they'd gone to check on Frank's house, because the one time I'd called to find out what they'd learned, the sergeant answering the phone had basically blown me off. "He's wanted for questioning and a possible murder," I told the man, but he informed me, in an officious voice, that he had nothing new to report at this time, and when they did, they would contact me. I had not heard from them since. "Why a baby?" Terry asked at dinner. Lost in my own thoughts, I looked up at her. "What? Why a baby? I mean, isn't that kind of a weird thing to hear? And why only you? How does that sort of auditory exclusion work?" She believed me, I realized. She really thought I'd heard a baby's cry,
and was trying to reason out the logistics of it. Her support touched me, boosted my confidence, settled me down. And I knew at that moment that I loved her. I was about to tell her exactly that when the phone rang. It was one of her friends from work. She took the call in another room and was on the line so long that the mood was broken. Conditions had to be right for such a life-changing admission. A big reveal like this required the proper frame, and I decided to postpone my announcement and wait for a more opportune moment. She was still on the phone when I poked my head in the doorway, held up the lockbox key, and indicated that I was going to return it to the office. She nodded in acknowledgement, waving goodbye as she continued to talk, and I headed out. To my surprise, May was at her desk, on her computer, when I arrived. May didn't usually work on weekends. That time was reserved for her family, she said, and I asked her why she was here as I put the key away. "We're thinking of moving," she told me. That was unexpected. She and her husband had bought their house in Chino Hills less than a year ago, a no-frills split level in an upscale neighborhood, and it had seemed a perfect fit. "Van wants something closer to work. The traffic's really getting to him. Me too. To be honest, it was just talk at first. We weren't really planning to do anything about it. But this new listing in Yorba Linda came up last week. It's not even officially on the market yet. And it's not only this great location, but the monthly payments would be 100 less than we're paying now."
"Sounds perfect."
"It is. The problem, though, is that if we want to sell quickly and maximize our takeaway, which we do, which we need to do if we're going to scrape up enough for a competitive down payment, we have to have some work done in this storage shed thing that's attached to the garage. I remember it. We either have to upgrade it or, more likely, tear it down and patch up that garage wall."
"If you tear it down," I told her, "you could plant a little flower garden in that spot."
"Gardens definitely help," May laughed. "You're always good on the visuals.
Part of the job."
"So are you working today?" she asked.
I shook my head. "No, I was just showing Terry that house off Lincoln."
"The haunted house?" she grinned. "See anything?"
"We were hoping to, but no."
"Don't give up."
"Does that mean you?"
"No, not exactly."
She shivered involuntarily.
"But I really didn't like the place."
"We felt nothing."
"Not everyone's on the same wavelength. Some people pick up some frequencies. Others pick up others. My haunted house might not be yours, and yours might not be mine. We all sense different things."
"I never thought of it that way. But it made a kind of sense." May picked up her phone again.
"I'm going to talk to Van. I think we will tear out that storage shed. And I think we'll steal your garden idea."
"Flowers," I told her. "Bright flowers, red and yellow. They work every time." I checked my email as soon as I got home to see if Scott Spencer had replied, but he hadn't. And I leaned back in my chair, closing my eyes. I had a throbbing headache, and there was a burning sensation in the pit of my stomach. Stress. Although I desperately hoped that Frank would be brought to justice, I just as desperately wanted to be left out of it. That did not seem to be possible, however. The crying infant I kept hearing guaranteed that I would be involved in all this whether I liked it or not. And my hope was that my ghost pursuer buddies could figure out a solution that would let me resume my normal life. Why had I tracked down Frank anyway? Billy. Billy. I took a deep breath. I wasn't just a part of this. I was right in the center of it. I went to bed early that night, tired, stressed, and longing for rest. Terry stayed up watching some cooking show, but when I awoke shortly after midnight, she was fast asleep next to me. Why had I awakened, I wondered. I usually slept through to dawn, especially when I was tired. Something must have... There was a tap on the window. Tap. Beneath the blanket, chills ran over the surface of my body. Terry was still sound asleep, an unmoving lump next to me. I wanted to wake her up, but knew I shouldn't. So I just lay there for a moment, hoping I hadn't heard what I thought I heard. Tap, tap, tap.
far more frightened than I wanted to be, I carefully pushed off the covers, slid out of bed, and walked across the darkened room to the window. Peeking through a space in the partially parted curtains, I saw a shriveled hand in the night outside, a wizened finger with a long black nail softly rapping against the glass. Behind the ancient hand, Irene. She looked just as I'd feared. Thin white hair blew gently about her wrinkled, emaciated face, while somewhere in her sunken sockets were the remnants of eyes, dried, darkened orbs too small to fill the empty black space surrounding them. Her mouth could do nothing but grin. The deflated lips were pulled back so far that they were unable to close, and the gums beneath had receded so far that the exposed teeth were huge. I almost cried out. It was my first involuntary reaction, but recognition that it would wake up Terry caused my conscious mind to override that impulse and kept my cry of terror down. Still, I closed my eyes and, like a child, covered my ears. Had Frank sent her after me? Or had she followed me of her own accord? Was she the one making noises like a crying baby? The very idea intensified my fright. I imagined that shriveled skeletal hag hiding somewhere just out of sight in Terry's parents' house or my office, her wreck of a mouth opening and closing to emit the sounds of a distressed infant. Opening my eyes, I expected her to be gone. But she was still on the other side of the glass, grinning horribly at me, that terrible crooked finger with its sharp blackened nail no longer tapping on the window, but beckoning me outside. I took the fingers from my ears, heard nothing.
What are you looking at?
I saw Terry's reflection in the exposed section of window at the same time she touched my shoulder, and I jumped, startled. I exhaled, aware that I'd been holding my breath.
Nothing,
I said. Don't give me that. She leaned close to the crack in the curtains, squinting at the glass, and it was clear she saw nothing, though Irene's emaciated face was grinning in at her. How was that possible? And why was it happening? I still didn't know, but it didn't really matter, because Terry was here, and she believed me, and I reached out and pulled the two halves of the curtain shut so I couldn't see out. I looked into her eyes.
I love you, I told her.
This was the right time. She smiled back at me, kissed the tip of my nose.
I love you too.
But she frowned in the split second that she glanced at the closed curtain before we both went back to bed.